This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Baltimore, Maryland, in particular, the Sagamore Pendry Hotel, right here on the water in Baltimore. I've been coming to Baltimore, God, since I was in junior high school on my very first, of course, class trip to Washington, D.C., we came right through Baltimore. I've always wanted to come back. I've come back many times since. Imagine a city founded in 1729. It claims to be the largest independent city in the U.S. But what's amazing is the renaissance they've had in the rebuilding areas of the harbor all around the city and maintaining the history as well and preserving the architecture. But I'm honored to be joined right now by the 50th mayor.
Yes.
Of the city of Baltimore and the third consecutive woman mayor in this city.
How about that?
How about that, Catherine Pugh? How are you, Madam Mayor?
I'm great. Absolutely great.
Yeah, you excited to be here?
I'm very excited to be here, especially with you, knowing all the great news that you spread around the world.
Oh, now don't you suck up to me.
I like doing that. So that when you leave here, you leave with this great impression of this great city.
But I've always had a great impression of this city.
Awesome.
Because I first discovered Baltimore, I'll tell you, I was in junior high school. And of course, we took our class trip to Washington, D.C.
Wow.
But
we
on
did,
the,
too.
It was mandatory, right?
Everybody.
But the thing is, on the way, we stopped in Baltimore.
Awesome.
I never knew anything about Baltimore. And I'm a boat person. I'm a water person. Look out the window here at this hotel. What are we looking at?
At water.
Yeah.
Beautiful harbor.
Yeah.
Beautiful boats, ships coming in. And surrounded by great hotels and retail space, wonderful restaurants.
You're starting to see a renaissance here.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's probably started some time ago, but what has happened is that our transformation has spilled over to the other part of the city. So we started early where we would call over by the, we call it the west part of the city. When we did the Columbia Magnet, we would call Mr. Jim Rouse, did the Harbor Place development. So it started there.
But that was a number of years ago.
Oh, that was moons ago. But what's happening over here is really transformative. I mean, that transformed that part of the city. And this is transforming all of, helping to transform all of downtown, as well as add to the footprint of Canton and other parts of our city that people don't get a chance to see.
Now, I know you're a Philadelphia girl.
I am, born and raised, but this is Baltimore is home. Yeah, and I'm a Ravens fan. And an Orioles fan.
Well, you have to be. You're the mayor.
Look, those were some great Eagles.
Yeah, you know what? I got to tell you, I was not rooting for the Patriots.
I had it
with the Patriots.
I'm Philadelphia Eagles all the way, and my dad would have been proud to see them win. So I had to cheer for the Eagles.
Well, you had to. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a certain arrogance about the Patriots. Enough already. Right?
Well,
you're not going to say that, but
I'm
just
not going to say
it. I knew you weren't.
I know the mayor,
it.
So I can't do that.
Well, it wasn't the mayor's fault.
I know.
No. But bottom line is, whenever I walk around Baltimore, and I'm sure you have the same experience, you walk through history.
Oh, no question about it. You know, this is the home of the Star-Spangled Banner. It is just a beautiful place of history. We think about just having celebrated the 200th anniversary of Frederick Douglass, who was a businessman here as well. It is the birthplace of some of the strongest African-American businesses in the country. This is just a wonderful place of history, Fells Point. And again, when you're walking around this particular part of the city, you're still walking on cobblestones.
Right, literally 8 feet from this hotel.
Right, where horses used to pull up and tie and be tied.
Why don't you bring the horses back?
Well, we are our police department. We used to have mounted police officers, and so we're building a new mounted police unit.
You see, this gets back to neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
This gets back to, you know, every police chief that I talk to, if they know what they're talking about and they know their neighborhoods, they realize that the key to good policing is knowing your neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
And policing the neighborhoods in on the old days of the cops who were on beats.
Well, what's interesting, we just named a new police commissioner who actually rode in the mounted police unit.
So you have an ally in that department.
So we have an ally in that department. We're bringing back the mounted police unit.
I grew up with mounted police. They used to quarter their horses. I'm a New York City boy. And two blocks of my house was the armory where George Washington used to quarter his horses.
Absolutely.
Guess what? So did the cops.
Yes.
And up until about 25 years ago, that's where they were.
Well, we're expanding ours. He's very excited about it. We are, and I'm sure the community will be excited about that as well. You were talking about the Humane Society here in Baltimore. And just think what that brings to the community, especially young people, to see police officers on horses, to be able to walk up to them and have conversations with them and their horses.
Well, you just said the big bad C word, which people have forgotten about. It's conversation.
It is conversation.
I mean, when you can, you know, here's the biggest problem that I have, for example, with airport security. They always ask questions that could be answered by yes or no. It accomplishes nothing.
Nothing.
Because you're not having a conversation. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things I do like doing is walking through neighborhoods and communities and having conversations with people. And the excitement, especially around what's happening here, the Pendry just represents just such a classic redevelopment of history in our city. This is where movies have been shot. It was shut down. And look what they've done. I mean, this is iconic. And if you've not been here, we certainly, and since we're talking on your show and it's worldwide, I get to invite people to come and see the Pendry because it is just absolutely beautiful.
Well, you know, I was talking to some of your folks the other day, and the bottom line is it's not just about talking about Baltimore in a one-dimensional way. People are going to come to the U.S. I'm talking about your foreign visitors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to fly into Dulles, or they're going to fly into JFK. They may not be flying to BWI.
Well, let me just say this to you, that there are more people are flying into BWI because of its access to Washington D.C.
Oh, listen,
and its ease.
It's a great airport. Look, your airports. You couldn't pay me to go to Dulles. I'm sorry. I love BWI for two reasons. One, if I'm taking the train, it's there.
Yes.
If I'm taking the plane, the train is there.
Yes.
Right? And how cool is that?
It is so cool.
But it's also underutilized.
Well, I mean, it's growing. It's growing.
Southwest
has made it its hub, and I tell Delta they might want to move up here.
You told that to Delta, didn't you?
Look, we'll give you some tax incentives to create a hub here in Baltimore.
Hey, well, listen, after the NRA, Delta might move here.
Delta might need to move here, and we'll welcome Delta right here. Well, you know, I think one of the greatest things about Baltimore is that we are cited on almost every list when you talk about the coolest city. Forbes just named us one of the top 10 coolest cities to visit and to live in. And then the New York Times, we are 15th among 52 cities around the world to visit. It is a city that you shouldn't miss. And Southwest Airlines, that 23, 24-page spread about Baltimore and all the activities.
Well, the cool thing about it, let's go back to your airport for a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never feel crowded there.
No.
You have a pretty good operational history in terms of getting in and out, right? I mean, there are no long lines, as you'll see at other airports.
Well, you don't have to catch a train to go someplace, I mean, to get out of the airport.
Yeah.
You can actually get off the plane and walk to your to your car, to your taxi cab, or whatever it is that's going to take you to your ultimate destination. You don't have to come out of the airport, get on a train, then at some point get to your destination, walk 10 miles, and maybe your ride will be there.
So you had the airport experience, I see.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I get to fly a lot and visit a lot of different cities, and I would have to agree, not just because I'm here, but because I've been in airports throughout the country.
You don't drive me nuts, and I understand the intention of it, but you go to the Charlotte airport, and what do they have? Rocking chairs, right? What's the message they're sending you? You're going to be here a while.
Wow, right, so relax.
Yeah, but the point is, you shouldn't be at an airport a while.
No, the purpose
you should be
is to get
an airport.
Through an airport, and we make it very convenient here in Baltimore. So, again, if you're flying into D.C., you might want to fly into Baltimore, and it's much easier access to Washington, D.C., easier to get through.
Well, you bookend it. You do both. You get a twofer.
Right. You can go to D.C., but you can come to the great city of Baltimore, and we welcome you.
You're not promoting the city now, are you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I think about all the attributes, look, we've got a big event coming up, Light City, real shortly, and we're inviting people.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later in the show.
Sure, because we're inviting people from all around the world. Come, over 500,000 people visit, so it's a great place
to be. Last year, it was almost 500,000 people.
Almost 500,000 people.
Amazing. Yes. Mm-hmm. To see a couple of light installations on the water.
It's not just a couple. We go out into the neighborhoods.
I know.
We invite everybody because it's just such a great event.
charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4.
Over the seas and all the degrees to anywhere I please. Oh, I want to get away. I want to fly away.
My next guest has the world's best name if you're in this part of the world. You can't make this up. Come on, tell me your name.
It's Johns Hopkins.
Okay, stop right there. But he also has a great title. He's the executive director of Baltimore Heritage. If you want to know about the history of this area, you're my go-to guy. I'm not going to ask you about how much trouble you had in high school with that name.
It's an eyebrow raiser. Pretty much every day is an eyebrow raiser.
I know, but you're here.
I wouldn't be anywhere else.
You know, the thing about Baltimore that I love is that everywhere I walk, I mean, you don't have to look far to find history.
That's one of the greatest parts about this city is our neighborhoods and our history is everywhere. We can touch it in every street corner.
I mean, even right in this neighborhood where this hotel is, it may not be good on your shock absorbers, but you're going down cobblestone streets.
Absolutely. And there's tons of stories behind that on trading beginning in the 1600s, mud-covered streets paved with the ballast of ships, and now we walk and drive on them in one of the greatest historic seaport communities in the country.
And, you know, when people mention historic seaport communities, Baltimore, in my mind, at least not until recently, didn't come to mind. I was thinking of New England, Mystic Seaport, of course, the New England Seaport, a New York City Seaport, but Baltimore played a huge role.
Absolutely. I mean, in addition to some of the finest privateers out there helping win the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 by capturing innumerable British ships, even one of our daring captains single-handedly ran a blockade of the entire British Isles running up and down the English Channel, somewhat farcically and colorfully, but full of Baltimore pride all along, to immigration, along with Ellis Island.
Everyone thinks Ellis Island,
right?
But it was here as well.
Hundreds of thousands of immigrants came into Baltimore's Locust Point, right across the water from where we are now, and thankfully, a lot of them stayed, and our city is very much a city of immigrants.
And a city of generations.
Absolutely, absolutely. Many, many, many people here are third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth generation.
I mean, when you came here, obviously you had to absorb all the history as well to be able to put it in perspective. It's all about context. But bottom line is when people come to visit you now, what do you show them that blows their mind that they had no idea actually was here?
There are a number of things that I like to show my out-of-town visitors. One of the stories that I think is a surprise is in our Mount Vernon neighborhood and the beginning.
But this is different than Mount Vernon.
Mount Vernon, Virginia,
right.
Correct. Although it's the same George Washington. We've got the nation's first monument to George, to our president and our general. But a story that doesn't get told as much is the founding of American philanthropy, the idea that you can go from rags to riches, and only in America, a guy named George Peabody went from a poor young boy in Massachusetts, made a fortune selling hardware in Baltimore in the early 1800s and decided that only in America, only in Baltimore, could he have gotten that opportunity. And he gave $1 million, a little over $1 million.
Back then, which was huge.
Which was enormous. It was sort of the Bill Gates and Warren Buffett magnitude back then. To found the Peabody Institute to help other people better themselves. Importantly, he convinced his younger colleagues, Enoch Pratt and Johns Hopkins, to do the same.
What was that name I heard?
Enoch, yeah.
No, the other name.
The other name. Well, that would be the name that I share. the other famous Johns Hopkins,
yeah.
Right? The famous one, of course, founded the hospital and university and medical school. Enoch Pratt founded the first free lending library in the country. So this idea of rags to riches and an obligation to give back that later generations like Andrew Carnegie, the founding of libraries all over the country, all came from Baltimore and really this cauldron of opportunity that we had. And I think the legacy is still there for that.
You know, when I was growing up and playing games like Monopoly, I came across this name. It was a piece on the board. And then I was going through the original maps of the Transcontinental Airlines, and they followed the railroads. Literally, they had
plane spotters. When Charles Lindbergh flew the first transcontinental flight on TAT, the predecessor to TWA, the actual map they flew was the rail line, and they had people on the rail line spotting the plane, and that was the B&O.
That was the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, right? The first starting point and the first mile of track of American railroading is still here. Wonderful museum, an enormous roundhouse, antique trains, and you can get on a train and travel the first mile of railroad track in America.
Which, by the way, probably beats Amtrak. You can actually travel a mile.
You can go the mile and you can come back and it all works.
It's amazing. But people forget, you know, we think Dwight Eisenhower said that the interstates built America. No, the trains built America.
Absolutely. That was our first real forays into the West, being Pennsylvania and Ohio at that time. But absolutely.
How far west did the B&O go?
Well, it was the Baltimore and Ohio. Its terminus was Cincinnati, and a lot of the folks, the immigrants who came through Locust Point here, got on the B&O Railroad and went to places like St. Louis and Milwaukee and Cincinnati, and their immigrant histories have a portal through Baltimore
City. It all came through Baltimore.
Absolutely.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You know, when you go around the water here and you go around the harbor and you see the renaissance, the rebuilding, the restoration, the renovation with a certain degree of care and concern for history, it's a pretty good thing. There's development and then there's common sense, and you have to hand it to the people who have redeveloped this area with a great amount of common sense. One of my guests who's joining me now, you know, we talk about celebrity chefs. And everybody has to have a celebrity chef with a celebrity television show. I call him a celebrity chef without a show that way. He's celebrity chef because he's figured it out how to keep it local and how to keep it pure. He's the executive chef at Gunther & Company, Jerry Trice. How are you, sir?
Good, Peter. How are you? Thanks for having me.
You got it. I mean, one of the things that drives me nuts at restaurants is they try to do like an experiential one-upsmanship game where...
Oh, yeah.
You know the deal, where you're...
We're a competitive bunch.
Yeah, well, you are a competitive bunch, but it's sort of like, you know, the silverware has to be art pieces, and every dish has to be sort of like this mystery of how many different ingredients is in there and it doesn't really make a difference at the end of the day. Obviously, there's a certain amount of showmanship involved in every restaurant because you want to feel entertained. You want to feel welcome. It's all part of the hospitality business. But you look at it in a different way, don't you?
I do. I think, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you really got to wonder how much time did they delve into this fork in your hand. And I think, like a Gunther & Company, where, you know, obviously I'm biased because I have some say in that, but I'd rather remember your name and what you drink and what you eat.
Well,
I think more hospitality than all the dramatics around you, because people can overcome a lot, but if you're not welcomed into a warm setting with people that actually care and give a damn about you, why would you want to come back?
Well, you also get into the stereotype aspects of what you eat. You know, the first time you mentioned the word Baltimore or Maryland, the next word out of everybody's mouth is crab cake.
That's right, hon. Crab cakes, riots, football. We're overcoming some of those. The crab cake game has always been here because Baltimore is for crabs. But at Gunther & Company, we really don't delve into the crab cake, the also-ran game. Because you can get that kind of anywhere, and it's never going to be as good as your mom made. It's never going to be as good as your favorite crab cake restaurant that one time in San Francisco, that one time in Baltimore. It's just, it's a highly perishable item. It's expensive. And they kind of gear it for like the 53-year-old Pennsylvania tourist. And I want to build lasting relationships. I'm not a one-and-done guy.
So you're not the restaurant that has the sign outside saying, "We welcome 53-year-old Pennsylvania tourists"?
Not a neon, no. It's not us.
All right, so you've made a conscious effort to steer away from the crab cakes, but you still want to be quintessentially Baltimore.
I love to eat them, don't get me wrong. We are quintessential Baltimore because, well, my wife is from Baltimore. I'm a Virginia native, but
all right, so you got to pass on.
I'm a transplant. Yeah, yeah, but that's still the Chesapeake Bay watershed. That's where the bounty of most of the things I was lucky enough to have in my life growing up came from. I was lucky enough to have a grandfather that, you know, teach you how to crab, teach you how to fish, teach you how to hunt, and this is where it comes from. And don't, you know, blank where you eat, but you can't. You got to believe in what you're doing, and Baltimore is believe. You got to believe in the Renaissance. You got to believe in putting roots down, and we are, you know, owner-operator. You have to walk the walk, and if you're not really into it 100% in your heart and your actions, you're not really going for yourself, are you? You're trying to spin it, and it's not. That's not a healthy place where I want to be at this point in my life.
Oh, but at the same time, somebody visiting Baltimore has certain expectations that you're going to say, put those on the table, let me show you something else.
Absolutely. The crab cake thing, I mean, almost all my oysters come from the East Coast. Most of them come from the Chesapeake Bay. That's the bounty that we're in currently seasonally. Crab is great. But if you're not supporting these crabbers in the winter when the crabs are buried underneath the mud, underneath the Chesapeake Bay, they're harvesting the oysters. That's what you should be doing. Invasive species as well, you know, the pufferfish, the snakehead, we use those too because that's what we should be using to kind of help support the whole ecosystem that's out there.
All right, so let's get down to definition of terms. I have not been at a restaurant lately where the menu says, tonight on the menu, we got snakehead.
You don't know me that well, Peter. yeah, the snakehead was kind
you have
of
a snake. You have a snakehead brioche? I mean, what?
Well, can't really advertise those things now because something about crossing state lines with the fish and the fine and something like that. But I have served a great deal of snakeheads in its inception when the evil things, the supposed, you know, frankenfish spawned its way out of the Crofton Pond. My restaurant in Annapolis, we serve them quite a bit, and they're a Japanese delicacy.
And now you're going to tell me they taste just like chicken.
Halibut, I'd say like cross between like a halibut and a freshwater eel.
Okay.
So that's nothing to sneeze at. That's a great fish.
And the pufferfish?
The pufferfish is kind of the blowfish that is another invasive species. And apparently that's...
Well, blowfish used to be described to me as chicken of the sea.
It is. It's delicious. They're little. They're, you know, about yay yeah. big, about 4 inches long. They have no rib cage. That's how they, you know, expand like that. They puff up. They do have the center vertebrate, so you kind of eat them like a chicken wing, like a buffalo wing, but it's fish. So when they mess with my oystermen sell them to me, and we dress them up and sell them. So it's fun to help out the environment and have some good snacks.
So I can walk into your restaurant and say, what's the puffer fish wearing tonight?
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. What's the one thing on your menu? Let's forget crab cakes now, but what's the one thing on your menu that would be surprising to me?
Let's see. Surprising to you. I think our Thai seafood hot pot might be surprising. Because I'm a white guy, and I get people complimenting all the time, like, that's great. How long did you spend in Thailand?
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care. I am a passenger.
Right now, I'm joined by the founder of a very unusual museum here in Baltimore. In fact, when we talk about it as a one-of-a-kind museum, we're not kidding. It's called the American, and she's got some explaining to do. It's the American Visionary Art Museum, and her name is Rebecca Hofberger. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm really well, thank you.
I mean, when you talk about something called the American Visionary Art Museum, that implies someone who's forward-looking, that implies somebody who's intuitive, that right, a lot of it to do with intuition. Right.
Yes, it's a national museum founded wholly on the belief that intuition is what fuels all truly creative things, not just what we call art, but in science and music and creative acts of social justice.
You got a lot on your plate there.
Yeah. Yeah, I use the museum as a scam to get on the phone to anybody I've ever really, you know, admired. So I've worked with Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Rosie O'Donnell in a year-long exhibition. On
together?
Yes.
Together?
Yes. He thought she was his driver because her idea of dressing up was like this little Nehru suit, and he didn't know who she was, but they became friends at our museum. And
the purpose of bringing them together was?
Well, every year I pick one grand theme that has bedeviled or inspired humanity. And I decided that we should look at character for a year communally. And it was called Race, Class, and Gender, Three Things that contribute zero to character, because being a schmuck is an equal opportunity for everybody. And people would cry in that show, and they would laugh. And actually,
you know, you could have just done a schmuck retrospective.
Well, I think that's being done at a large scale right now. So.
I'm not going there.
Don't go there. Okay.
No, but the point is, you can have fun with this museum.
Yes, very much so. I have to say, I did a show on religion to celebrate the 800th birthday of the poet Rumi. And who was in town but Matt Groening, who created, you know, the Simpsons, everything else. And his son was really unhappy here at some school. And so he came 5 days in a row. And he said, I go to museums all over the world. I've never been absolutely brought to weeping openly in any museum.
What made him cry?
I think we have that element in almost every exhibition. There's something that will tickle that part of you that opened you up. But at the same time, I said to him, well, I'm doing an exhibition on authentic joy, and I've never met anyone who has made more people laugh.
Okay.
And he
stupid
became,
question. Wait,
yeah.
I got to give you the.
Go ahead.
How do you do an exhibition on authentic joy?
Well, you look at...
First of all, how do you define it?
Well, that's a very good point. So what you look for are subsets of it. I had to look up what was the oldest joke book ever recorded. It turns out it was from the ancient Greeks. And when you look into it, it was a book entirely of flatulence jokes in ancient Greek. Even then, they thought that was funny, particularly men. So I had from Mel Brooks, I had
Blazing Saddles.
Yes, I had
the fireplace, the campfire scene in Blazing Saddles.
Exactly,
the legendary scene. Yes.
Or I think the title of the gallery was Toot Sweet, you know, from his Beans. So that was one. And then it turns out that the greatest work of art at the very well-funded Cleveland Art Museum is a 300-year-old Asian scroll, and it's beautiful in all the way Asian art can
now,
be.
Now, please don't tell me that at the end of the scroll it talks about farting.
No, the entire scroll talks about the fart wars between the Buddhist monks.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and it's absolutely beautiful, but that's the only subject of the entire huge, scroll.
So what you're saying, Rebecca, is if I get to the top of the mountain in Nepal,
yes,
or in Tibet, and there is the Dalai Lama, and I ask him about the meaning of life, he's going to fart and tell me to go to the museum?
No, but he did write for us. He wrote an essay for us. So this, for example, we work with many Nobel Prize winners. We work with people who are kind of hidden saints who do an awful lot of good with very little fanfare.
Well, all kidding aside and all fart jokes aside.
Yes.
I mean, this is a museum. If your mission is successful, it's to open my eyes in a completely different direction.
Correct. I'll tell you one thing. Right now, our great mystery show is up, and I look at some mysteries. And one of them
is
the mystery of the human heart. And I read scientific journals all the time because, for me, that's such cutting-edge, fresh thought, you know? It inspires me a lot. So I found out that researchers in Australia discovered that our human hearts have taste bud receptors in them, not for sweetness or salt, only for bitterness. And it turns out when we're full
of... That explains a lot of my friends.
Yeah. Well, it explains why broken heart syndrome, when people would die
of a broken heart.
Yeah, but they would do autopsies and there would be no blockage to the heart.
Would you please explain to me the Edgar Allan Poe connection?
Yes. Baltimore has always been a cauldron of kind of intense creativity. And
Edgar Allan Poe is here.
Edgar Allan Poe is here. He's buried here.
The Raven.
In a Rosicrucian pyramid grave that you can visit. But I always like to tell people a riddle. And that is, what do Jerry Lee Lewis, as in Great Balls of Fire, have in common with Edgar Allan Poe, the father of the modern mystery?
And by the way, how did you find this out, which is the craziest thing? Go ahead, tell me. I already know. Go ahead.
They both married their 13-year-old first cousins.
As one would do, I guess.
Yes. Well, back in the day, yeah. But just the whole city.
Wait, you didn't ask. How did you find that out?
Well, I was a young member, lifelong member of the Edgar Allan Poe Society. And when I saw it, I knew that they both had that in common. So I put it together.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. But there are other connections here.
Yes. The Ouija board was patented here by two warring brothers. And one of them wanted to run for city council, and you couldn't be Jewish at the time. And so he stopped that, and that part of the family became Episcopalian, and the other stayed observant. But the Ouija board was here.
Wait. When was the last time you saw one or even used one? A Ouija board.
Oh, we have it in our current show, The Great Mystery Show, right now. Are you kidding? They always have it like during times of flux. People want to know if their child on the other side of the world.
No, time of insecurity.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? We need it right now.
Yeah, but Baltimore, like the first shots of the Civil War, did anybody tell you this? Is like almost a stone's throw from this hotel. They were Southern sympathizers who shot at Northern troops coming through on Pratt Street. But there's so much richness here, like the Great Blacks and Wax. Great Blacks and Wax is the most unbelievable.
Oh, no. I know it.
So I'm very proud of that. We have a world-class symphony that should be number one best paid. It's number 14 on the 14 orchestras in this country. And I'm telling you, Marin Alsop is a genius. So our movie history, you love John Waters. My gosh, we have a 10-foot statue of Divine at the American Visionary Art Museum. And
you have a 10-foot statue?
Yes, of Glenn Milstead, a.k.a. Divine. You can genuflect there. And there's such a rich thing. You know, Diner. I bet you're a Diner fan, are you not, Barry Levinson?
Well, Barry Levinson's a Baltimore guy.
Absolutely. So I'm saying it's a city of creative one-offs. And if that's in your DNA, this is a great place to come and live. There's so much here. In the words of Jim Rouse and our third building, did you know the actor Ed Norton is his grandson?
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. So the developer of the Inner Harbor, Jim Rouse of blessed memory, we have the Jim Rouse Visionary Center. And he said the best thing about cities. He said cities were meant to be gardens in which to grow beautiful people. And if they're not doing that, they're not doing their job.
All right. So I'm asking other guests this question too, but I'm going to ask you this.
Okay.
The derivation of Charm City.
Oh, we've gone through so many things. I'm telling you, Peter, we've gone through City That Reads, and everybody said, oh, no, they'll say City That Bleeds. But the Charm City was really under our mayor, Schaefer, at the time, who was quite a character, who was kind of a charmer, would dress up with a duck and, you know, an old-fashioned bathing suit and jump in the harbor to promote it, shameless, you know, in a good way. And, you know, there is that idea that it's full of charm. It was also called the City of Monuments for years because we have such an incredible array of statuary.
See, I thought the rumor that I saw about Charm City had to do with a bracelet.
Oh, you know more? See, you have to. See? You're the prophet from out of town.
I make it up as I go along. No, no, but somebody actually told me that.
What about Baltimore would be a likened to a charm city?
Well, no, it came from a charm bracelet. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that.
See?
I'm sorry.
You were too busy with the Ouija
board. Yeah, I was. And with Madame Murray O'Hare, who knew? Yeah.
The original atheist.
Yeah, the one who took prayer out of school. She did it from here.
Right here.
Yeah. But also the Quaker movement was so strong here. Whether you hear the name Johns Hopkins or whether you hear, you know, Enoch Pratt for our libraries. And then you had Frederick Douglass who came here and had, you know, was kind of a great engineer at the shipyard. And that literally would be outside the the door to the Sagamore Pendry. There's a small museum
dedicated to him. That's where Frederick Douglass was.
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
We're talking with Rebecca Hofberger, the founder of the American Visionary Art Museum. In your entire museum, what would you say is your most surprising exhibit for someone like me?
Oh, right now I have a DMT molecule chandelier made by a local artist.
DMT means?
It's the psychoactive part of ayahuasca. And we have the mystery.
I knew that.
It's the mystery of what it is to be a human being, of life and death, and how do we know what we know? You know, when we say I, what are we talking about? Because most of our bodies, we have about 30 trillion human body cells, but we have 39 trillion little parasites, viruses, bacterias, that we are like the planet, you know, we're the system that we're walking around, hosts all that stuff. So the question is, what I think St. Francis said, what we're looking for is what is looking. And you're a good looker. I know that you go around the world feasting. You've got the best scam going of anyone I know. You go to cities. They open up everything for you, Peter. You're one genius to have figured this out.
Listen, I'm still trying to get over Jerry Lee Lewis and Edgar Allan Poe. What are you talking about?
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. My next guest, 25 years ago, figured this out. She actually founded the nation's first wax museum celebrating Black history. And her name is Dr. Joanne Martin. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And it's right here in Baltimore.
Yes, it is.
Now, when I say I didn't know this, until we did our research, I didn't know that even such a museum existed. This is news to me.
And we hear that a lot. And amazingly, for us, most of our visitors are from out of state. And they do return visits. We've been in a number of publications and news media. So our name is out there, but not far and wide enough.
And in recent history, you know, when I heard the president, you know, say that Frederick Douglass is doing a great job, I was like, wait a minute. Even I had done my history on that. I'm assuming Frederick Douglass is a prominent feature in your museum.
In fact, we unveiled a new wax figure. We've had him from the very beginning. We started out with four wax figures.
Who were your first four?
Frederick Douglass.
A lucky guess on my part.
Mary McLeod Bethune, Nat Turner, and John Brown. And
okay, the second woman you mentioned, Mary.
Mary McLeod Bethune. Yeah.
Tell me her history.
Mary McLeod Bethune, she was a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. Mary McLeod Bethune started a school, a college in Daytona Beach, Florida, that still exists. It was Bethune-Cookman College at the time, and now Bethune-Cookman University. She started out with almost no money, and she sold sweet potato pies and so forth to get her her school started. A lifelong commitment to education.
All right, now, Nat Turner, of course, for those people who study Black history, we know all about Nat Turner.
We do. But one could say that his, and my husband, my late husband Elmer, used to say that history could be divided into, the whole idea of slavery could be divided into BNT and ANT before Nat Turner and after Nat Turner, because he changed a lot of the thought, some of the things that came into being, like the fugitive slave law and the crackdown on slavery, because the idea that you had these happy darkies toe-tapping them their way way through the cotton fields, and Nat Turner and any number of uprisings showed that that was not the case.
That turned it around.
That turned it around.
Of course, I'm sure you have Underground Railroad people.
Oh, yes. Interesting Underground Railroad people, like, of course, you expect the Harriet Tubman.
Right.
We have a scene in the museum where Thomas Garrett, the white abolitionist from Delaware, is putting a slave through a faux stove, and on the other side of the stove is Harriet Tubman, because it's a tunnel. And Thomas Garrett worked very closely with and helped to fund a number of the Underground Railroad effort. We have Henry Box Brown, who mailed himself to freedom. So, yes, the Underground Railroad story is prominent in the museum.
Okay, for those of us who are somewhat more enlightened than others, and I'll put myself like somewhere middle in that list in terms of black history, who is the one person featured there that is your surprise person who really was pivotal in black history that people may not recognize?
Well, I guess there are so many. What people tend to respond to is our slave ship exhibit, because they have no idea about
how it was.
Of how it was. They have no idea about the duration of it. That the slaves did not go gently into that good night, and so that
they were chained.
They were chained, but they looked for every opportunity, every weakness in the captain and the crew to fight, to revolt, to rebel. And so rebellion was a very prominent part of that experience. But also that you had three groups of slaves. You had the men's quarters, women's quarters, and boys' quarters. And so boys as young as 6 years old were on the slave ship. Girls, very seldom were there girls younger than 12, because they weren't childbearing age.
Oh, boy.
But boys were very prominent.
Amazing. Where is the museum located?
We're located in the heart of Baltimore City, East Baltimore, at 1601 East North Avenue.
Well, if you're looking for a different experience, and one that I would actually say is unexpected, especially if you grew up watching Madame Tussauds, this is a whole different experience.
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
When you walk into this hotel, I mean, I remember, you know, the old harbor. I remember a lot of things that weren't done. This is an amazing piece of architecture, even if it wasn't a hotel. And if you go back in history and you find out what it did, that proves the point. But my next guest, you know, has seen the change happen. He's the general manager here, David Hoffman. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Peter. Great to have you.
Yeah, I mean, quite a transformation.
An amazing transformation, what they did with this property. Built in 1914, this pier, and to have the vision to really transform it into this amazing hotel is really spectacular.
I mean, it was built in 1914 as what?
Well, it was built initially as you heard earlier, Locust Point was a great port for immigration, and people would come through this building to get into the United States, and then it really became a community center.
I saw a very old guy down there with stamps on past. Yeah, yeah. No.
Exactly. Yeah. He's still there. He's our doorman now. But they, you know, this became a community center, and then it became the rec pier, recreation pier, and that's where people gather to tell story and dance and have fun.
But we're talking about the 1920s, 1930s.
That's right, exactly right. And then in the later years, it became a movie set. Homicide: Life on the Streets was filmed here. Some great movies like Step Up and Step Up 2 were filmed here. So I know those are your favorites.
Oh yeah.
Some really great things happened on this property.
Yeah, you were correct, except for that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, this is part of a total transformation of this area.
Total transformation. What's happened here in Baltimore and what's happening still is really amazing. It's an incredible place to be right now, and some really amazing experiences to have.
Now, you and I share one thing in common. We both went to school in Wisconsin, but I went to Madison, you went to Marquette.
Uh-oh, this is a problem.
It is a very big problem. I'm still talking to you. At one point, you had a pretty good basketball team.
And I see a great future ahead of us, that's for sure.
So do the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
I just had to mention that.
Had to take a stab, yeah.
But listen, you've been a GM or a resort manager in a number of different properties. This is a big challenge, too.
Big challenge. You know, I've been with Montage International, which is our parent company, for 15 years, starting at our first property in Laguna Beach. And Opening in a hotel in Baltimore is interesting. It's retelling the story of what this community is about and how great it is. And it really is an amazing community to be in, and we're excited.
But when you talk about challenge, it's one thing to transform a waterfront. It's one thing to transform a neighborhood. Then you got to make it work.
That's exactly right.
And what did you do here in the design of this hotel? When you had a building that was basically protected, it was historic. You had to work with the footprint you were given. So what did you do differently that you were able to do to make a bigger difference?
Well, I think it started with the construction phase of this property. I mean, we had to do almost 500 pylons into the water just to structure it. And one of the neat things about doing that is we came across three cannons underwater that date back to the 1700s, and we pulled those up, and they're now located within the property. But the simple structure and the historic and design of art of this hotel and combining those three was really a challenge.
And, of course, you've got – I mean, this is a particular interest of mine – you have a whiskey bar.
We have a whiskey bar, and one of those cannons is buried in the floor of that whiskey bar, and it's now called the Cannon Room.
And with enough whiskey, you can actually fire the cannon.
There is no question about it. We can fire those cannons with the whiskey in there. A lot of Sagamore rye is served through that room.
Explain, it's interesting. People talk about whiskey. There's been, essentially a revolution in terms of the American product, but almost immediately rye itself.
Exactly. Sagamore, the rye whiskey industry is taking off right now, and we're trying to bring that back to what was such an important part of this community ages ago. And the Sagamore rye whiskey, which we distill right here locally across the harbor, has had a great impact and has really taken off within the community.
So, but what you're telling me is you can source it.
I can source it. That's exactly right.
You have an unending supply.
Unending. Whatever you need, we can get. But that's one of the great relationships we have and some of the great things we do with this property.
Now, obviously, everybody wants a room with a view, but you've got a room with a view. You got a hotel with a view. How did you manage light? How did you manage design to be able to do that within the square footage that you had?
Well, that's a great question, because the square footage was always a challenge. And one of the nice things we talk about is we're not on the water. A lot of hotels can say they're on the water. We're actually over the water, which is really a great aspect of this property. What's interesting is you talk about the water views. People are really enjoying our courtyard views, which have the view of the steel beams, original beams from 1914. And that
if I can paint the picture here, we're talking high ceilings.
Absolutely. Yeah, our ballroom.
And we're talking steel you couldn't find today, give or take anybody else's government tariffs. They don't make that kind of steel anymore.
The steel you couldn't find and the crown moldings in our ballroom, the height of our ceilings, 45-foot ceilings in our ballrooms, and bringing
so
back
So someone those, can literally swing from the chandelier.
Absolutely.
Let's just admit it.
I hate to tell you, it's happened already a few times.
Has it really?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. There's some amazing parties that happen up there.
So basically, you can market this hotel as having a reinforced chandelier?
That's exactly right. You're very true in saying that. We've had some amazing experiences up in that ballroom, I got to tell you.
I read those police reports.
Yeah, exactly.
But bottom line is you could work with a very strong structure.
A very strong structure. And that's what's so special about this property, is bringing it back to its original state and keeping those structures in place, which was so important to us.
Plus, you had to basically perform to the building codes of a historical building.
That's exactly right. And that's why you'll see the original floors in our Sagamore Ballroom. These are the original floors from 1914. You can hear them creak as you walk across them, which just brings back that history.
But those planks are thick.
Those planks are thick.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.